I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Friday, a SEPTA mechanic found a crack in something called the car body bolster in one of the elevated train cars in Philadelphia. More cracks were found, so the transit agency pulled 60 cars from the Market Frankford line. The L is used by an estimated 187,000 riders every day. This discovery comes on the heels of one-third of SEPTA's regional rail fleet that was pulled from service this past summer because of bad welds. We asked Jim Saxa to join us once again to talk about SEPTA. He covers transportation for WHYY's Plan Philly. And Jim, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back, except if you're a SEPTA rider, I guess.
Well, in fact, let me give out that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Especially want to hear from the L riders. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Jim, what did the inspectors find? This takes us back to Friday, but what did they find?
Right. So on Friday, they're doing a sort of routine full inspection of this one car, car number 1091. And as they ripped up the floor where you'd be standing on the train, they were going through and they saw on what's called a car body bolster, a pretty large crack, 8 inches out of the 23 wide. And that's a critical part that sort of connects, you know, the body of the car to the trucks that they run on. The trucks hold the wheels.
Described as a kind of a support beam.
Yeah, it's a critical support beam, you could say. They run the width of the car. And so, you know, whenever they find something that's that wrong, they usually launch a full inspection. And what they found on a lot of cars, on 58 of them, were cracks in a part that's welded to the car body bolster beam, a vent box that provides cool air for the traction motors that are on the wheels. Those are things that, you know, make the car go, right? And so what they suspect was the cracks in this non-structural part that was welded to the structural part through the weld, essentially, spread to the really important part on two of the cars they found so far. They're going through the inspections of the 58. It's easier to look at the vent box. They developed a scope, essentially, and have been able to go through all 220 of their rail cars that they have on the L. And they're able to only find the 58, and now they're going through those 58 to make sure that their bolsters are okay, and to correct the cracks on the vent boxes.
So what has it been like for L riders in the last couple of days going to and fro from work?
Right. It's not as bad as it was for the regional rail riders over the summer, where a very similar, you know, sounding problem, a support beam had cracks in it, right?
Yes.
That took out a third of that fleet. Here, we're talking about closer to a quarter of the fleet. And more importantly, SEPTA doesn't need as many of its fleet. Let me put it a different way. SEPTA has a lot of extra cars on the Market Frankford line, right? They have
this
200.
This is the L for people that
L.
are not familiar.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
So for the L, they have 220 cars. To run at their full peak service, they only need 144. With the cars that were out for regular maintenance and routine maintenance and these extra 60 or so cars, they're down to 108, which is bad. You
right.
know, you can't run the usual every 4 minute intervals in the morning, but it only reduced service to every 6 minutes, and that's the same that you have regularly on the Broad Street line. And so it's not great, but it's not terrible.
These train cars, as I understand it, are about 20 years old. Is that considered old when it comes to a train car?
You know,
middle age.
Yeah, I guess middle age. Most cars need to do some serious overhauls at around like 30 years. There are some cars out there that are 40 years old. But from what I understand, SEPTA they're looking to do some pretty rigorous overhauls of these cars. They've reached that age. It's not clear yet whether or not they're still under warranty with the original manufacturer or if these parts – I mean, usually these sort of things, different parts have different length warranties. So the SEPTA didn't know that at yesterday's press conference yet. That'll be something we'll be checking up on, though.
How about the subway, the Broad Street line? Is that affected in any way by what's been going on with the L?
No. So, you know, this goes back about 100 years ago, but the company that built the Market Frankfurt line, they didn't want other trains to run on their line. So they built the width of the tracks a different width than the standard gauge. So Market Frankfurt cars can't run on other tracks and vice versa. So they have to buy and maintain a completely separate fleet just for the L.
And this is something that goes back 100 years. Some obviously
this
some
was
kind
a decision
of...
made. I want to say in 1907. Don't quote me on that,
okay.
That date, but around then.
Well, help us understand then what SEPTA, how soon I guess they hope to get things back to normal.
That's a great question. They didn't
know.
They did not know. We don't know how long it's going to take at this point. They say they're working around the clock. Again, because it isn't inconvenience, at least, again, compared to the terrible inconvenience that was the regional rail crisis over the summer, and the fact that SEPTA is putting, you know, safety paramount here. You know, the safe guess would be a couple weeks.
Is it a coincidence we're talking about welds again? We talked about that when it came to the regional rail cars that were pulled, and now we're talking about welds when it comes to the L.
It could be. I don't really know. There's some debate amongst transit nerds, for lack of a better term, about whether there should be such reliance on welding on some of these critical parts. There's an argument that done right, welds are just as strong as machine parts, meaning, you know, you don't weld anything, you bolt it together, you build things in one whole piece, as opposed to slapping together two pieces and welding it together.
Right.
I don't know enough about metallurgy to be able to even guess about the validity of either side's argument there, though.
The question, in fact, an email from Steven says, when SEPTA went on strike last fall, I took to using the Indigo Bike Share program to get to and from work with the newly discovered problems with cars on the Market Frankfurt line. I'm, again, thankful I have the bike share option, and clearly it's great to have as many options as you possibly can. Should people be afraid to use the L based on what you know?
No. SEPTA, I mean, the interesting thing about this problem is that it showed no external signs at the time. They sort of stumbled across it because they do regular maintenance and regularly overhaul or, you know, review and inspect their trains. They haven't had a serious accident since 1990.
Right. And that was a serious accident.
That was. That led to three people. It was a derailment that led to three deaths and another 150 people killed. And that was on the L. But, you know, that was a long time ago, A, 27 years.
Right.
And B, they've been really, really, really serious and earnest about, you know, putting safety first. So I wouldn't be concerned, you know, especially compared to some other agencies out there, like, you know, Washington, the Metro there, they have a really terrible track record of, you know, killing their passengers.
Well, talking about other transit systems, and that, of course, gets us into a discussion about infrastructure. President Trump has talked about a large investment. It looks like a public-private kind of investment into infrastructure, but talking about spending a lot of money. I remember President Obama talking about infrastructure spending. I remember President Bush doing the same thing. I think the needs are clearly there. And I guess the question is there money? Is there will? What do you think?
That's a great question. So during the campaign, President Trump pledged $1 trillion, but he didn't say how he would do it. You know, that's sort of standard for him in the campaign. He made a lot of bold promises, but no one really followed up with how he would accomplish them. And now there are people trying to figure that out. The problem is no one's on the same page, and I'm talking about no one within the Republican Party right now. So Paul Ryan has said he wants doesn't even want to think about an infrastructure bill until after the Affordable Care Act has been repealed and replaced. It took a full year for the Democrats to pass the ACA. Most people, I think it's safe to say, expect it'll take just as long, if not longer, for an ACA replacement to happen. Then we also need to have a budget, Paul Ryan said, before he considers it. And Paul Ryan wants this bill to pay for itself, which means finding cuts elsewhere. And we're talking about $1 trillion. So when we're talking about $1 trillion, it's now believed to be $1 trillion in private and public investment together. And the idea is to leverage public investment to lead to private investment in infrastructure. But in order to do that, you need projects that pay for themselves. And most public infrastructure spending is not done on things that pay for itself. It's done on things like non-toll highways and new water pipes and public transit. And most of those things are not good private investments.
Does anyone know what the infrastructure needs are for the Delaware Valley for here?
Oh, yeah. We have a full list.
And there's a bridge that has a crack that's now – not being used.
Yeah, the Delaware River Turnpike Bridge has a crack in it that needs some work. We have 30,000 bridges in the state of Pennsylvania alone. 6,000 of them are structurally deficient, which is the highest percentage of structurally deficient bridges in the U.S.
That's about 20% of bridges.
We have a huge need. SEPTA has a pretty large list of things that it would like to do to just maintain and improve upon its system and then to expand. There's no gap in need. The problem is most of those needs won't pay for themselves. And so when you start talking about how would you pay for it, you need to add tolls to roads that don't have tolls on them. Do we want to toll the Schuylkill Expressway? Do we want to toll I-95 through Philadelphia? Bill Schuster, who's a Republican from Western Pennsylvania who chairs the House Transportation Committee, he said that tolling roads is a non-starter for him. And if we don't do things like that, you won't get the prime investment that the Trump administration says that they want.
We're almost out of time here. You mentioned the regional rails, the problems, the fleet that was pulled. Is everything back and up and running for regional rails from what you can glean?
Yeah, about a week or two ago, they got the final cars that were out of service back in service. You'll see until the end of the month, you might see the occasional MARC train or an NJ Transit train that they leased from different agencies.
Pretty much back to normal.
They have those trains. They're keeping them, and they're going to use them. They have the lease up till February, to the end of the month.
Well, Jim Saxa, thanks for coming in, talking about transportation here on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And he covers transportation for WHYY's Plan Philly. Well, we are shifting gears after this very short break where we're talking about Russia and the United States, President Trump and President Putin. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. The admiration that candidate Donald Trump had for Russian President Vladimir Putin confounded and concerned a lot of people, including Republicans and national security analysts and advisors. Now that he's president, that relationship could alter U.S. foreign policy. A number of American allies in Europe are nervous about an emboldened Russia and Trump's perspective on Putin, sanctions, and NATO. Today, we want to understand how Trump views Putin and vice versa and what this all means. Let's begin in 2013. Donald Trump is being interviewed on Russian television right before the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow.
Do you have a relationship with Vladimir Putin, a conversational relationship, or anything that you feel you have sway or influence over his government?
I do have a relationship, and I can tell you that he's very interested in what we're doing here today. He's probably very interested in what you and I are saying today, and I'm sure he's going to be seeing it in some form. But I do have a relationship with him.
Here's Donald Trump at a press conference on the campaign trail last year at the Commander Forum, Commander-in-Chief Forum, an interview on Fox, a debate with Hillary Clinton on This Week with George Stephanopoulos at a press conference after being elected, and this past Sunday being interviewed by Bill O'Reilly on Fox. Let's listen.
I never met Putin. I don't know who Putin is. He said one nice thing about me. He said I'm a genius. I said thank you very much to the newspaper. And that was the end of it. I never met Putin.
But do you want to be complimented by that former KGB officer?
Well, I think when he calls me brilliant, I'll take the compliment, okay?
He's certainly a respected leader. He's respected in his country. He's actually liked in his country, which is hard to believe, because he's essentially a dictator, and he's actually liked in his country.
Because he'd rather have a puppet as president of the United States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear you won't admit
that the
Russians.
In all fairness to Putin, you're saying he killed people. I haven't seen that. I don't know that he has. Have you been able to prove that? Do you know the names of the reporters that he's killed? Because I've been, you know, you've been hearing this, but I haven't seen the name. Now, I think it would be despicable if that took place.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do.
Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
Let me introduce our two guests. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Dan McCormick, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania's Christopher H. Brown Center for International Politics. And Dan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Yuval Weber. He's an assistant professor at the National Research University Higher School of Economics at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. And Yuval, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
So many questions, so much stuff to detangle here. But let me begin with a very basic question. And Yuval, let me put this to you. Is Vladimir Putin a killer? Has he killed people?
I don't think he's killed anyone personally. But the way that Russia works is it's like, Henry VIII and Thomas a Becket. Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? It's that sort of thing. The people around Putin understand where is the general direction of policy. And so if they understand that there is a person or an issue that needs resolving, well, clearly the sentiment filters down from the inner circle into sort of darker and darker corners of the Russian political scene. And then at some point, somebody who's not taking any personal directions from President Putin will recognize this is the person who is the impediment to keeping politics going and keeping us in power. So there's never a direct connection between Putin and somebody dying, but there is essentially the vibe that gets very well understood by people who can take care of essentially troublesome priests.
There's a story this morning about a man named Vladimir Kara-Murza, and he is pretty well-known critic of Putin. And also, he says, and I'm quoting here from the New York Times, he calls a Kremlin policy of assassinating political enemies, and he's fallen into a life-threatening coma caused by an unknown poison, his wife said on Monday. And apparently he has been poisoned or allegedly poisoned in the past. I don't want to connect dots where they don't exist, Dan, but how do we make sense of a coincidence like that?
This is a pretty common pattern. This is not the first time we've seen this, is the way I would put it. There have been a number of opposition politicians and individuals that have spoken out against the regime there that have ended up mysteriously poisoned in some way. So,
and some are lawyers, some are journalists,
yes.
Some are wealthy people.
Yes. So when you say you don't want to connect the dots, I think it's probably okay to connect the dots.
You do?
Yes.
Meaning,
I agree with what you've all said. Could we convict Vladimir Putin in an American court for having these people murdered? No, we couldn't. But it's clear that this is being directed from some level of the government.
So what does that tell us about Vladimir Putin?
I think it tells us he's a killer. I mean, I think the difference, we were talking about this before the show, has the United States killed people? Yes. The logic here is that it's in our national security. You may disagree with that, but that is the logic. Putin, the regime in Russia, uses murder for the regime's security. So this is a domestic political mechanism to keep the regime in place, not national security. It's directed to keep Putin himself secure.
And is it working, Yuval?
Well, the guy's been in control either directly or more or less directly for 16 plus years. So there seems to be some life to that. And sort of in the sense of what Dan was talking about, pretty you know, not random people who get sort of this sort of treatment of, you know, polonium poisoning or whatever's happening to Mr. Karamurza, but it is people who speak out. So if you are essentially someone who may have some info or you may have something that is against the president and you see people being poisoned, well, that's the message to you. Whatever you have, keep it to yourself.
I'm looking again at the paper today. Russia sought an apology from Fox News on Monday after the host Bill O'Reilly described President Vladimir Putin as a killer during the interview with President Trump. This was also said by George Stephanopoulos. It was also said by Joe Scarborough. So there seems to be, Yuval, a narrative, at least in this country, coming from some of these journalists. But it does raise questions about how Donald Trump views Vladimir Putin. How do you see it? And then I'll get you, Dan, in on the conversation as well.
So there's a lot to say between Trump and Putin. A lot of it is basically trying to figure out, like, who Mr. Trump is or who President Trump is. At minimum, during the campaign, Trump was not receiving a lot of help from any foreign leaders. You know, without even sort of the issues about elections. But it was clear that only President Putin wanted to see Trump in power. And I think Trump then sort of grabbed onto that as this is my safe zone. And sort of what we can also think of, what was the relationship between Trump and Putin beforehand? The dossier that came out right after the election had sort of the unfortunate Golden Showers episode in it. Right. But what was much more interesting to me is that it also described the real estate connection between Trump and all the oligarchs who've taken their money from Moscow to New York and are basically in, you know, that super rich guy scene, of which Trump is clearly a part of. And so what it seems to me is where the relationship existed before politics got involved was clearly President Putin wanted to understand what were Russian oligarchs doing in New York, and I'm sure that's the connection to Trump. And so that was essentially the pre-existing friendly relationship, even if there's nothing on paper, right, that can go towards building the personal relationship between the two leaders.
Dan, let me read read a tweet that President Trump tweeted out this morning. I see it. It's 4:11 a.m. He says, "I don't know Putin. I have no deals in Russia, and the haters are going crazy. Yet Obama can make a deal with Iran, number one in terror, no problem." Now he says he doesn't know Putin and he has no deals in Russia. How can we verify what President Trump says there?
Well, there are a couple of components to this. The first of them, that he doesn't know Putin, we can verify pretty easily with his own statements. He was either lying before or he's lying now. The second, that he doesn't have financial ties. I would say this. There are a lot of accusations swirling around about the connections between Trump and Putin and Russia more generally. It is impossible right now to know whether these are true or not.
Right.
What we can say is that Trump is absolutely complicit in creating the conditions where these sorts of rumors can fester and grow. He is the most opaque, secretive person we've ever had as a president. He could release his tax returns. This would go an enormous way towards letting us know whether he has financial ties to Russia. So, and this is a very much of a piece of, you know, formerly Soviet, now Russian propaganda, where it's not just about releasing compromising information about other leaders. It's about creating the conditions where these sorts of rumors can be believed. And it not only compromises President Trump, but it compromises the ability of our government to make statements that we can trust.
Based on what you just said, and assuming it's true, then how does that benefit President Trump to create this these questions, this confusion, this not knowing what this relationship is all about?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think it does benefit him. And so given that, I am left to conclude that there must be something pretty bad in the tax returns.
You think so?
Otherwise, why not release them? This is what I don't understand. I really don't understand. It would clear up a lot and it would really neuter a lot of these criticisms. So given that, I can't come up with another conclusion other than that there's something really damning in there.
Yuval, how should we understand how President Putin views President Trump? And we certainly have lots of comments that President Trump has said about Putin and the way he seems to admire him and certainly not criticize him. Is the feeling mutual?
No, I can't imagine that President Putin respects Donald Trump in these sorts of ways. But it's clear what Russia wants from the United States. And, you know, just given all the crazy things that have happened, President Trump might be the only person who's able to deliver. What sort of Russia wants, sort of really big picture stuff, is they want to be recognized as a great power. And this is essentially, you know, it really goes back to what President Putin has done over his 16 years in power and what the post-Soviet universe looks like to Russians. So before coming to teach here at Harvard, I spent about 4 years in Russia. And for Russians, the problem with the world is that, and this is sort of a bit of older history that your older listeners might remember, there was the Malta summit in November 1989. This is between Mikhail Gorbachev and George H.W. Bush. That brought the Cold War itself to an end. And the Soviet Union recognized and Gorbachev recognized that they may not have been sort of the hyperpower of before, but they would have been a superpower. They would have been a leading power within Europe and within the world, you know, partnership with the United States. The fact that the Soviet Union itself came to an end 2 years later effectively voided that deal. So what Russian leaders since then have been trying to get back to make the world look more like 1989 than 1991. So what President Putin wants right now, be a great power. So this is effectively what the, particularly the intervention into Syria is meant to demonstrate. Great powers can project power into different regions of the world. They can also make themselves indispensable to the international politics of other regions. And specific to where this overlaps with President Trump is President Trump has clearly made his number one thing on the campaign trail, and obviously what we've seen over the last two or so weeks, is anti-terrorism, anti-jihad sort of foreign policy. That is what President Putin has also been talking about for a number of years. So what President Putin wants to do is be in Syria, not least to protect one of his allies, but also to demonstrate his anti-terrorist bona fide.
And the last thing
I'd want to say on that is demonstrate the anti-terrorism, but and so it's using that cooperation to get the sanctions relieved, which has crippled the Russian economy.
And again, that's Yuval Weber and Daniel McCormick, our guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the relationship between Russia and the United States, between President Putin and President Trump. Yuval, just a quick follow-up. When you say from Russia's perspective they want to be seen as a great power, is that for domestic consumption or is that for consumption by the outside world?
It's essentially both, but more for domestic consumption. You know, one of the ways in thinking about what leaders can do for their people, we have a very odd perspective in the U.S. because the U.S. is so powerful. But generally speaking, other countries, they want to provide economic growth and international relevance. The economic, that's sort of a general thing. And in Russia, the problems with the economy literally go back hundreds of years, but at least within the past couple decades, the problem are lack of diversification away from oil and gas exports, so that when the oil prices took a dive in 2013, before all this Ukraine stuff happened, what the result was there was the price of the ruble for relative to a dollar. And because the price of oil is priced in dollars, that made everything super cheap if you're holding dollars, pounds, euros. So then when the Ukraine business started and the sanctions came in, that prevented a huge influx of outside money into Russia.
Right.
So what Russia needs in terms of sanctions relief is the ability for, let's say, foreign oil companies or foreign, you know, whatever, to come into the Russian economy. So if the Russian economy is based on oil and gas exports, but that can't happen because of sanctions, well, the people who actually pay for that are the Russian people who have experienced last year's economic growth was negative 3.7%.
So clearly,
if we can think back to
an economy in trouble.
the economy is in a huge amount of trouble, and the problems there are structural and U.S. sanctions and lack of diversification. So they need to demonstrate international relevance so that essentially between the basket of goods of, you know, economic growth versus international relevance, if we're not getting it on one hand, we got to get it on the other hand.
Let me pick up.
That's essentially the basis there.
Sure. And let me go back to you, Dan. Is Russia being threatened by radical, violent Islam?
Yeah, I see this as one of the two main areas where Trump and Putin think that – or Trump thinks he can collaborate with Putin on. So he very much shares with Putin the diagnosis that the fundamental security threat to both countries is radical – is what they insist on calling radical Islamic terrorism. Trump – my read is he sees being able to create a big deal, a good deal, wherein he cedes control over – Europe, or at least Eastern Europe, in return for cooperation from Russia in terms of putting the Middle East in order, more or less.
That has made Europe very nervous.
Has made Europe very nervous, yes. It undermines the sort of the fundamental reality of European politics since the end of World War II is American power, the presence of American power there. And this provides both to Europeans and Americans a great number of goods that are pretty good. If you believe, as I do and as most people who study this do, that these institutions, NATO and the UN and the EU, have appreciably led to the reduction in the likelihood of a third world war, well, the benefits of this are incalculable. And Trump is really just whittling away at the foundations of this.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Daniel McCormick and Yuval Weber about Russia and the United States, Putin and Trump. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me reintroduce our guests. Joining us by telephone, Yuval Weber, assistant professor at the National Research University Higher School of Economics at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Also with us, Dan McCormick. He's with us here in our Philadelphia studio, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania's Christopher H. Brown Center for International Politics. And again, talking about U.S.-Russia relations, the relationship, such as it is, between President Trump and President Putin. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dan, let me go back to you. And I mean, clearly it looks like President Trump is working to create a more friendly relationship with Russia and with President Putin. And then we have U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley saying, we do want to better our relations with Russia. However, the dire situation in eastern Ukraine is one that demands clear and strong condemnation of Russian actions. This escalation of violence must stop. So how do we reconcile what seems to be contradictory things coming out of this administration?
Yeah, I think this really highlights the fundamental reality of how far outside the foreign policy mainstream Trump is. Even the people who are relatively outside the mainstream that he's found to stock his administration with still don't agree with him. It's still, for them, a bridge too far. And you can see this in comparing the statements like the one from Ambassador Haley to the ones that are coming out of the White House. So the other day, they had the readout from the call with Putin, I believe, where they talked about the war that's occurring on Ukraine's borders.
Mm. That was the language that they used.
This isn't right, though. The war is not occurring on Ukraine's borders. It's occurring within Ukraine. Putin might well describe it as occurring on Ukraine's borders after they've been moved westward, but this is not the reality of what's happening.
Yuval, do you think Ambassador Haley was freelancing there? Are we getting kind of mixed, or maybe a good cop, bad cop approach from the Trump administration?
I think, as Dan said, it's unprecedented in U.S. history that you have people who have what seems to be fundamentally opposed foreign policy views on the same team. Right. And it seems that the people who were brought onto the foreign policy team, such as Nikki Haley, James Mattis, and so forth, were brought more for their sort of background, or in the case of Nikki Haley, to at least have one woman of color, like, on the team. So it's really unclear whether Haley, Mattis, and so forth are trying to box in Trump rather than taking directions from Trump.
Well, you feel like people on his own team are trying to box in their boss?
It clearly seems that there are people in the team who have to talk to actual foreigners, and they are coming with a much more mainstream, much more predictable sort of U.S. point of view, whereas those people don't seem to be as close to President Trump, like in a literal physical sense. Haley's in New York. Jim Mattis is going around the world.
Right.
And the people who are most directly connected to Trump have a much different view on what foreign policy should be. And so what it seems to me is that literally proximity to the president is the type of message that you'll receive.
Dan, you want to
so
add?
That is very troubling.
Dan,
yeah,
you want to
yeah,
add?
Yeah, I would say calling this a good cop, bad cop routine is imputing way too much coordination and strategic thought to the administration. I think it's just – it's chaos. They're not coordinating their message. I don't think that the president has control over what these individuals are saying, because I don't think they've had discussions about it. There were several weeks after he had named Mattis and Tillerson. During Tillerson's confirmation hearings, he said, I haven't actually talked to the president about his views on Russia. This is insane. I just don't think that there's coordination. It's not some grand plan.
So which is more worrisome, that there's a grand plan or that there's chaos?
The coordination is worse. Absolutely.
Yuval, let me go back to you. It's interesting. This is Russia's support for Marine Le Pen, and she's running for president in France. And apparently, according to some reports, that she has been getting funding from Russia. I'm not sure who specifically. But does that indicate some kind of view coming out of Russia, a view of more extreme politicians?
Oh, for sure. And so for Marine Le Pen directly, over the last several years, she's actually admitted it herself. Because she wasn't able to get funding from French banks for her political activities, she borrowed money just around 10 million euros from a Russian-owned Czech bank in Prague, of which the owner of that bank has been a Russian intelligence agent from the 80s and 90s, but apparently retired at some point. So the coordination there, again, I don't think Marine Le Pen takes direction from Putin directly, but what Putin wants out of Marine Le Pen is a strong anti-Europe voice. So that one, big picture, bring the European Union to an end. But in the meantime, essentially create not just this left-right dispute within Europe, but to create essentially this cleavage between, as what Dan was talking about earlier, this sort of the liberal establishment, and liberal in the sense of close connection to the United States, NATO, having the European Union, having European integration. Where Le Pen and Putin come together, or where they overlap, is using anti-Islamic rhetoric and action in order to break apart the center from the extreme and to make the extreme more normal. And so whether Le Pen brings the European Union to an end through a referendum or whatever else, just slowing down the European Union and making the sanctions policy much harder to coordinate, making Europe just bedlam. And what Russia has always wanted is when the European Union speaks as one voice, it is far bigger, far wealthier, far more powerful than Russia. But if Russia can negotiate, particularly when it comes to energy policy, on a bilateral basis, pretty much only Germany can hold its own. So Russia would prefer France and Germany and Belgium and so forth for all the 27 European countries rather than dealing with one European voice. And so that is Putin's view on where Le Pen could take Europe.
Let me go
use European nationalism to weaken the EU.
Dan, let me go back to you. And President Trump has said that he wants a better relationship with Russia, with the president of Russia as well. We know that Obama talked about a reset. Hillary Clinton certainly had some conversations and dealings with Russia. So what should the U.S. relationship with Russia be based on what you both have just said?
What should the relationship be? I think Obama finally found his way towards what it should be in the last like month or so of his presidency, which was bolstering NATO to a greater extent where it borders Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I personally am a little bit skeptical of calls for NATO enlargement at this point. But I think the administration would do well to push back consistently against Russia where it's causing trouble. And that's
like Ukraine.
Like Ukraine, yes.
Crimea.
Yes.
Meaning what?
I think we should be arming the Ukrainian government to a greater extent and making more clear. I mean, what we haven't talked about yet is one of the things that the administration has done so far is really undermine trust in what's called Article 5 of NATO, which is the article that says an attack on one member of NATO is an attack on all members. And Trump has really directly attacked this principle, which is – I can't emphasize how wrongheaded that is.
Mm.
This is what's underwritten European stability for the past 70 years, and he's throwing it away because he wants a couple million more dollars from
– Well, he's saying you haven't paid your bills and we're we're holding NATO together.
Right.
Is he right on that though?
Are we holding NATO to – yes.
I mean, are we sort of shouldering more of the financial responsibility
for
NATO?
Sure, yeah. That's what big countries are supposed to do. It's easier for big countries to underwrite global peace for a lot of reasons, and that's what we've done, and it's worked pretty well.
Do you, Yuval, does Russia, though, see Western expansionism? Does Putin feel or fear there could be some kind of – color revolution within his own country and he could be thrown out of power?
So, sure. And this is – so, in fact, what is the official rhetoric of Putin is to say we have been threatened by NATO expansion. NATO comes to our borders and that's the threat itself. And so what we'll actually get basically over the next, for however long Trump is the president of the U.S., we'll see actually what – Russian foreign policy is actually made of. Because if Trump is going to make the international environment for Russia as benign as possible through whatever sort of detente policies that Trump wants, you know, for anti-terrorism purposes, if the international environment and the U.S. president is going to call into question, like, the Article 5 pledge, not think NATO is very serious, so on and so forth, if Russia responds in turn, well, then it means that Putin was really afraid of color revolution, that he was afraid of NATO expansionism, because clearly he's afraid of people taking power at home. However, if the issue is more to the extent of he wants to be a great power, well, this is going to be the time to strike and get as much as possible from the U.S.
Let me read some comments here. An email from a listener. Of course, Haley wasn't freelancing. She takes her orders from the president. It's part of diplomacy to keep countries guessing. An email from Richard. Why isn't there more investigative news breaking on the links between the Trump campaign organization and the Russian hacking operation? A comment from Mary. Putin never called Trump brilliant or a genius. He called him a colorful character. According to exiled Russian journalist Masha Gessen, the Russian word for colorful, I can't say that, is bright as in a bright star. An email from WM. Trump and Bannon are practicing the chaos theory in politics. Just a flavor for what people are thinking. So going back to you, Yuval, I mean, are we in some version of a new Cold War?
Well, the old Cold War was based on the competing interests in which not one particular issue was worth going to war over. But when there's a multitude of interests of which you can't find a compromise, that's what defined the old Cold War.
Right.
What differentiates this period isn't sort of in kind, because there's a lot of basic issues that the United States, early through Barack Obama's time, or I should say from Truman through Obama, in which there were clear differences on values and interests between the United States and Russia. Who knows if that's true, going forward. But we are in a new Cold War in that neither side wants to go to war,
right,
but neither side wants to compromise. So that essentially has, it's like in kind what was the old Cold War, but at a much lower degree of importance.
And that's Yuval Weber, along with Daniel McCormick, talking about U.S.-Russia relations. Dan, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I would say the other big difference between the Cold War and the current period is that during the Cold War, in the United States and Western Europe especially, there was broad elite consensus about what policies should be taken in response to the Soviet Union. That is not true anymore. We see this with Britain, the UK leaving the European Union.
The Brexit, right?
Right. We see this with the potential victory of Le Pen in France. We're now seeing these domestic cleavages within Western Europe and the United States that really didn't exist for the last half of the 20th century. So there's a potential for these cross-national ideological alliances between Putin, Trump, the National Front that has the real ability to fracture this order that has held sway for the past 70 or so years.
So what do you, as you kind of look into the future, Dan, what are you going to be watching? What should we be watching to help us understand where this relationship is going?
So this is really terrifying to say, but I would say the one thing, and this goes back to what I said earlier, the one thing that I can see all these groups being able to cooperate on is the agreement that Islam is a fundamental threat to Western civilization. And I see if the National Front wins in France, that there could be a real coordination to try and remove Islam from Western political life, whether that's by interning individuals or sending them out of these countries, I'm not sure. But that's the one area where all of these groups can find common cause.
How about for you, Yuval? Mm-hmm. And are you, we're about a minute or so before we have to end our conversation, but are you worried about Western Europe being, in a sense, sacrificed for this effort to go after radical Islam?
Yeah, and sort of as Dan said, you know, there's really scary domestic potential in Western Europe plus the United States. And the foreign policy component of that would be effectively to have this endless war against jihadism or Islamist terrorism that essentially has no end. And so what we could see is basically a multi-month, multi-year, essentially indefinite war against terrorism in the Middle East, which of course just creates more people who want to fight the United States and Western Europe. So we have for all of these Western leaders both the incentive to carry on an endless war and essentially the supply coming from the Middle East to give them what they want. And that could do a tremendous amount of damage.
Isn't there a war weariness, though, in Russia, having had to deal with Chechnya and Afghanistan? I'm thinking of these other things, Yuval.
Very
quickly.
So the war on Moscow Nightly News is going swimmingly. There is no problem with the war in Syria. It is actually illegal to announce war deaths in peacetime in Russia. So there is no problem with this war because it, in a sense, doesn't exist. Well, so there's no war weariness as such.
I hear you. Yuval Weber, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Assistant professor at Harvard University's Davis School for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Dan McCormick, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks again.
You're welcome. Postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania's Christopher H. Brown Center for International Politics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks for joining us.